only do when I do live. It's just
Right.
real pain in the ass. But I've got to go over to Facebook now and go live, which I think if I do this, that should mean that we're live in multiple places.
Awesome.
So, yeah, I mean, Crowdcast used to have, I think it used to do it natively, but instead, Facebook changed something, and now you have to kind of start one before you start the other. So
Okay.
you have this kind of weird, lag before anything else happens. But anyway, well, we've got about 20 people watching on the Crowdcast, which is cool. I don't know how many Aussies are actually in the Facebook group. There's 1500 in the group, so I'm not sure how many of them are actually awake and looking at it now, but hopefully
That's
we'll get a couple hundred there as well.
hopefully there'll be a few. It'll be what, 4 p.m. over East, so a lot of people coming towards the end of their day.
Yeah, and they slack off around 3 anyway, don't know, these East Coasters.
Beer o'clock,
So
mate. Beer
yeah,
o'clock.
that's it. Anyway, we're live, so welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 32. And I am kind of delighted to be here. I'm in Perth, beautiful Perth in Western Australia. And I'm super enthusiastic today because my regular co-host Adam Gordon has yet again been upgraded. This time I'm with Stan Rolfe, my good friend Stan. How are you doing, sir?
I'm fantastic. Thank you very much, Hung. A few bird scrapes from the bird beak earlier today.
Indeed, I had the pleasure of meeting young Rosie, and she's a feisty one, isn't she? Goodness me.
Cheers.
Yes, yeah, so for people who don't quite understand budgie, so Rosie's actually Stan's 1-year-old budgerigar, and she's got this free roaming kind of license in Stan's place, which I'm staying in right now, so I'm very ha happy to make acquaintance with Rosie. Anyway, I'm pleased to be in Perth. A reason why I wanted to do kind of Brain Food Lives co-located in these different places because I'm always interested in the local conditions of recruiting in different territories. Even though recruiting is a simple job and there's universal challenges, there's always local nuance that's going to have a big impact in terms of how it's done in the area. So we've got some fantastic guests that are going to be joining us in a moment. And I'm really looking forward to getting them on screen. But before we do that, let's have a chat about last week's recruiting brain food. That's how we always start the show. So Stan, I hope you had time to read some of it.
Yes.
And if not, then make something up. But if you have, what do you what was particularly interesting for you in recruiting
Yeah,
brain food last week?
there are a couple of articles there that really stood out for me. One of them was around AI systems and it being seen or considered as co-workers. It was an interesting
Yes.
article because one that I actually read, I merely went back to about 18 months, 2 years ago, where I read an article about Google DeepMind, and they were talking about it becoming very, very aggressive. And it worked out a way. They were playing a game, and in that game, you could win by shooting or killing off an opponent. And the game in Google DeepMind ended up killing all of its opponents to win. And they were like, wow,
Right,
okay,
right,
this
right.
is. So it was a bit of a contrast to where people are thinking now around how it can aid, and certainly you can see how it can benefit, but it was just interesting recalling the Google DeepMind example or article from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so if people who weren't aware of the post, I've just posted it into the chat stream there. And it was a really interesting speculation, wasn't it, by this chap who's kind of thinking, let's go beyond thinking about how AI is going to change recruitment. But let's think instead about, because we know it's going to change it, but let's have a think instead about what role they're actually going to play. And I particularly liked how he said, look, are they going to be competitors to us? Are they going to be colleagues, or are they just tools? You know, are we going to dominate them and use them? And I think he finally ends with a more dystopic version of, look, are they actually going to be the masters and we're going to be the tools? Yeah, super kind of interesting speculation. It's good to see that we're advancing the thinking around AI. I think we're losing a little bit of the skepticism and getting a little bit more nuanced on the topic, which is great progress. Cool beans. What else there, Stan? What else is interesting in issue 155?
One of the other interesting ones was around how your brain drown. Well, they're talking at the article. I think it was called "To Pay Attention, the Brain Uses Filters, Not a Spotlight." And
Yeah,
for
yeah,
me,
yeah.
that really resonated around the recruitment marketing space. Around there's so much content and and noise. How do you filter out all that noise, but not necessarily focus on it? But how the brain works is then, well, for me, it was how do I then adapt that to my recruitment marketing strategies and tactics to find the people that I want in a very, very noisy, crowded place? What is that? And especially in the unique sort of environment that I'm currently working in, where I'm focused more so around Aboriginal employment, Indigenous employment and engagement, it throws up a whole bunch of different challenges.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to diving deeper into that with you, Stan. But that was a post from Quantum Magazine, which I've just shared into the chat stream there again. And it was just a very simple kind of correction, I think, in terms of how, you know, we think attention works. We don't use a spotlight. We don't focus. We actually filter out. And he had loads of great examples in video as well, which showed how we did that. We often don't see the things that are literally in plain sight, because if we're told to focus on one thing, we'll literally screen it away, like the dancing bear, right? The dancing bear example is quite a classic one. If you haven't seen it, play the video. It's actually quite cool. But no one sees the bear, right? Even though it's a dancing bear in a basketball court. Crazy stuff. Anyway, what else is interesting, Stan?
The better engagement relationship with improved performance. I thought it was a really interesting article. I related that one back to the sports environment. An example of that at the moment is there's a particular athlete, Australian footballer, that my club is trying to chase down, playing for another club on the other side of the country for the last 2 years. This player has put his hand up and said, I don't want to play for this team. I want to go and play for my team, the Eagles over here in Perth. And the last 2 years, his performance has been outstanding. I think he polled, he either this year would have been their best and fairest or would have been in the top three. And this is a person that wants to leave their club. So are they engaged in the club? Probably not, because they're engaged in wanting to come and play for the team over this side. But their performance hasn't declined. I think that comes down to an individual and their own values and morals and ethics around, do I continue to perform and do what's right by me, which indirectly impacts the club. So that was a really interesting article there, that the data actually says there is very little correlation between the two.
And that was actually shocking, because the entire employee engagement movement is kind of along the lines of, look, if they're engaged, we're going to get more productivity and get better as a business. But this blog, Science for Work, which I recommend everyone reads, by the way, their entire thing is to say, look, we've had enough of all of these thought leaders. Let's just break it down and not publish anything that doesn't have some research behind it. And their latest blog on this topic was literally to say, you know what, some of your most engaged employees are actually really bad performers, because they're just too happy having a great time. So it's like going back to old school management. You know, they're happy and engaged, they love it here. Guess what, they're not productive. And it could be we're getting this entirely wrong. And in fact, I think they're kind of they don't dismiss employee engagement, but they do say that there's no point in doing employee engagement unless you also measure performance in parallel to it. So if all you're doing is sending out surveys and saying, oh, are you happy with work, and, you know, all this type of stuff, pointless to do that unless you're in parallel also measuring how they perform in work as well. Super interesting. Okay, cool. Last one, Stan. Anything else that you want to talk about from last week's Brain Food?
They are probably the three that certainly stood out for me, and relatable, very relatable to a few things that I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah, cool. And what are you doing right now, Stan? I mean, you talked about it's a new job for you, isn't it, that you recently moved into?
So I maintain my APAC coordinator's hat for Talent Board. So continue to help organisations improve the candidate experience. And that's with Kevin Grossman and Lee Carpenter out in the UK. But I've recently also started a gig as the recruitment manager for a company called Aboriginal United Services, which is an Indigenous owned and operated business. And we supply, it's a diversified mining services business. So we do a bunch of different things, but I look after their internal recruitment as well as their external recruitment and building their labour hire business as well. Right. Equal opportunity employer, but there is a focus on sourcing, hiring Aboriginal people.
Right, so that's super interesting. And I would say nobody outside of Australia would have the first clue about this, what the challenges involved there. I would also imagine a lot of people within Australia might be a little bit kind of opaque about this. So tell me about how this works and what is the, you know, how do you go about doing the job with that mission?
Yeah, it's an eye-opener now. What's been really great by the government and large corporates in Australia have made a pledge, I guess you could call it, of 3% of revenue to go towards Aboriginal-owned organisations. And you know, there aren't a lot of us, but if you talk about the top 50, top 100 ASX businesses in Australia all committing 3% of their revenue towards engaging Indigenous businesses, that's a lot of work. They're finite resources in terms of, I think there's about 250,000 working age Aboriginal people in Australia. So there's not a lot of them. Most are located out in remote areas of Australia. So how do you reach out and connect with those individuals? And one thing I've noticed recently is the large number of people who request FaceTime. So the Aboriginal people don't really like the ones that I've been interacting with. They're fine using the telephone, but almost always they have then said, can I come in and see you? And they want the face-to-face contact. And that presents a whole host of other issues around there's only so many hours in a day to meet people and then try and source them, search for them. So from a resource perspective, what does that look like? So very interesting. And then there's some other challenges around, unfortunately, they have a high incarceration rate, 3 times more likely than a normal Australian to be incarcerated for all sorts of very menial reasons, and that's also a huge preventer in them securing employment here in Australia, and in particular WA, when most of the work is on mine sites, oil and gas projects and the like, which require a police clearance to get site access and therefore a job.
Yeah, that's super interesting, Stan. In terms of the, you know, one of the things that I've been really interested in very recently is how do we as recruiters in general help the formerly incarcerated back into the economic system? And this a lot of work this has been happening out in the US and with Smart Recruiters in particular, really pushing this forward with their hiring success event. And it's occurred to me that actually, you know, recruiters have a very significant role to play here, because I remember back in my day as an agency guy, I did reject the guy out of hand because he had a record. Yeah. And I remember not even presenting that guy to the client because I had made the assumption, which may or may not be correct, but that's not the issue. I made the assumption the client would reject him based on the fact he'd done time. And by my using that bias, that was clearly biased to this gent, I stopped him from having a chance at that opportunity. But it probably was not an uncommon decision that recruiters would make. So this guy would probably be in repeated situations being bombed out, and the path back to productive society is cut off. So there's now a movement really to say, look, we need to forget about people. They've done the crime and they've paid the price. They've come out. That should be clean slate. And I'm definitely want to push and pioneer for that. But what is the state in Western Australia? Is it a case where if you've committed a crime, you have to declare it, for instance? How long does it get wiped out? What's the situation?
Yeah, so typically people apply for what they refer to as a national police clearance. So you pay a fee, you get a certificate. On that certificate, we'll list the last 10 years worth of convictions. And they can be from loss of license all the way through to grievous bodily harm, some of the more serious offences. I think it's after 10 years or 7 years you can get your conviction spent. People forget to do that, but they can get them spent, and therefore those charges no longer appear on their police clearance. So, there are some law changes as well. There's a high incarceration rate of Aboriginal women who don't pay fines. So if they don't pay fines over a period of time, they get incarcerated. That goes on their police records. So that's actually working its way through the parliament at the moment around, come on, it actually costs more people, cost us more to put people in jail than for them to pay the fine. So it's crazy.
We absolutely know this. I mean, it's very, very clear that, you know, incarcerating people is generally counterproductive. It's super expensive and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't protect wider society per se, at least in 99% of the cases where it's non-violent crime. You actually then put the mark of Cain, if you like, on these people, who in most circumstances, the crimes are driven by economic circumstances. You're basically saying there's no way they can come back, which is a damn shame, really.
One of the a mining magnate here in Australia and in Perth, Andrew Forrest, he owns a business called Fortescue Metals Group. He does a lot of that work, and he's really been leading that charge over the last year or two, which is great to see. A very large employer, a man of great of prominence in the business world, actually really encouraging and pushing more organisations to say, hey, we need to start, we can't find people. We've got people that can work, who are incarcerated for whatever reason or have criminal convictions. Let's engage with this community and, you know, help improve lives, change lives, help the community.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't want to go into the racial element as well, although that's clearly significant. I'm just reminded again also of the US scenario in particular where you have enormous, like horrific numbers of usually black men, I think, have interacted, if you like, with the justice system. 1 in 3, I believe the number is. And if you have this really harsh, a policy that you're not going to hire people because they've previously been incarcerated, you're really condemning a large segment of an underprivileged community to a lifetime outside of economic productivity. I've just shared a link there with the TED Talk by a friend of mine called Shelley Winner. I don't know whether you know her.
Nope.
But she's formerly incarcerated, but she's now an advocate for the people that have been in prison. And she's a really inspirational lady, great person to know. And I'm very happy that we're starting to see this type of thing. In the US, I think there's even a job board for this, where, if you want to, employers who want to kind of put their money where their mouth is, if you like, you can go ahead and recruit people who've come through the justice system. And there's certain companies are doing it on their own back. I know in the UK, there's a business called Timpsons. I don't know whether you know these guys, but they do fixing shoes. If you're in a tube in London, there will be a Timpson's shop there, which is basically like a shoe shine type shop, and it will cut keys for you, do that kind of thing, and you will notice that their staff will sometimes look like individuals that have gone through a very tough upbringing. And the reason for that is because they've allocated, I think, 10% of their working population must have come from people who've gone through the criminal justice system. So massive credit to Timpsons for doing that. But that gives people very clearly a way back into productive society and not locking them away literally from getting back involved. So yeah, super interesting stuff, man. Brookie Stan, listen, you've just started that job, so good luck with everything you're doing. I want to
keep you
updated on it. We've got other people we want to bring onto the show that also know like a huge amount of what's happening in Western Australia. And the first person I'm going to bring on to the show is Danny, if she's there. Let me see if Danny Tamati is there. She's commented recently, so she has been. So I had the pleasure of meeting Danny yesterday for the first time, having known of each other and interacted online for years, it seems. So very pleased to invite her on. And we'll see what she can contribute to this conversation about what recruiting is in Western Australia, You mentioned actually, Stan, while Danny's on this, that mining is a big deal here. I mean, that's very clear from the high-rise buildings. Most cities it's banks, but in Perth it's like minerals and mining businesses. So there Danny is. Danny, how are you doing?
Good.
Hey, Danny.
Yeah, great to see you. Danny, could you just introduce yourself to people who might not know you? Who you are and what do you do?
Sure. So my name is Danny Tarmody. I've been in the mining and resources sector in WA for almost 26 years. Next month, I celebrate that milestone. I was working fly in, fly out, 13 weeks away, 3 weeks home when I first started in the industry. And then I did live in the Pilbara, which is remote, in WA for 14 years, where my husband and I raised our 4 kids before moving back to Perth. I've been involved in recruitment for just shy of 21 years, and I love the industry and everything that it stands for.
That's amazing. I didn't actually realize that you were so intimately involved with the mining side of things, because we just stumbled onto this topic, but straight away you're using terminology that people from outside of Australia wouldn't know, you know, fly in, fly out. So people don't understand that a lot of these jobs are like super remote. They're literally in a mining site in the Absolutely. Middle of nowhere. So,
and And just reverting back, to the Indigenous employment too. So back in about 2006, we implemented an Indigenous employment strategy when I was living in a mining town called Parabidoo, which was made up of about 1,200 people. And that was to engage Indigenous people from remote communities, which were around about 80 k's from where the mine sites were, to be given the opportunity to come on site and try different types of employment opportunities across obviously different disciplines. So say, for instance, they might do 2 weeks in mobile equipment, they might do 2 weeks in HSC or admin, drill and blast or operations. And then they could choose after the end of that duration, which I think from memory was around about 12 weeks, whether or not they wanted a position in mining and exactly which area they wanted to work in. So, you know, we have been engaging Indigenous candidates for some time. Some companies have, but there is great value in obviously supporting and bringing people from the lands into mining roles.
Sorry, Sam, you were about to say?
I was just going to say, Danny, tell the people online here just how far away Parabidoo is, because we talk about remote and fly in, fly out, but... Yeah. Just how far away is it?
So 4 kids in a Nissan Patrol used to take us 16 hours to drive from Parabidoo to Perth for any family functions or anything like that. We came down for the AC/DC concert once with 4 little kids under the age of 10, and we left on a Friday at 4 a.m. in the morning, got to Perth late that night, went to the concert on Saturday and left Sunday afternoon to drive all the way back again. So you're talking 1,600 kilometres, which in miles I have absolutely no clue what that is, but it's, basically a long time in a car.
That's almost the classic Australia of the movies, isn't it? When people think about endless outback, endless landscapes and very, very few settlements or any human beings at all in those places. So recruiting challenges for people in Parabidoo. Obviously, you're going to do your best to recruit locally. I mean, is it entirely locally, or do you actually need to recruit people to fly in and fly out?
Absolutely. So when I first moved to Panawanika, which was another mining town, that's where I met hubby, and I got my start in recruitment, that was purely because I was working for the agency that had all the contracts on site. And then they recognised that they needed somebody in town to be able to manage the 60 or so contractors that we had, because the closest town was a 2-hour drive away. So if anybody had an incident or there was any concerns around payroll or timesheeting or whatever the situation might be, somebody had to get off site quickly, then, you know, there really needed to be hands on the ground. So we did employ a lot of people locally, obviously, as many as we could. The challenge there is that a lot of the time some of them are unskilled or they need a lot of training and development for certain positions. And then we saw a huge influx in fly-in, fly-out around about 2000 was really when the fly-in, fly-out model started coming into the mining and resources sector, from my recollection anyhow, and I've been in the game for a while. And then that brought its own challenges because, you know, when you're living in these remote towns, you're living there with your family, with your children, there's schools, there's limited shopping and things like that. There's a truck that might come in once or twice a week to deliver food. But with a fly-in, fly-out components. I say Panawanica at the time was probably 70% residential, 30% FIFO. You know, then obviously there's more and different infrastructure that needs to be considered when you're looking at, you know, that different type of a workforce.
How do you sell fly in, fly out?
You sell it easy these days because we all want, I mean, like I said, I lived in the Pilbara for 14 years. So I lived in company housing that wasn't that fantastic, but it was cheap and it, you know, and it gave us an opportunity to have our family and grow up in the Pilbara. Whereas now hubby's FIFO, he works on an 8-6 roster for BHP, and which is 8 days on, 6 days off for those that don't know. And he absolutely loves it. He only works day shift. He flies out on a Tuesday morning. He comes home on a Tuesday night. The money is fantastic. The kids and I get to live in Perth. I joke that I want to go FIFO. We have that conversation regularly. But fly in, fly out, it's a lifestyle that I think most people in mining who have got some kind of an influence in mining in particular, like my children, for instance, we've got four kids. Our eldest is in his third year of doing a boilermaker apprenticeship. Next year he's most likely going to be going fly in, fly out on a 2-1 roster, and he'll most likely start on about 140,000, you know, Australian dollars per year, which is a lot of money for a 21-year-old.
So this is a popular option. This is not something that people are going to reject, especially if they're used to seeing people doing this type of work. Like, you know, you see your father, your uncle, your brother do this type of stuff, then it becomes like a normal routine, I guess.
It becomes a lifestyle that you get just, that you are accustomed to, and that it's in the downturn. So we've just been going through the worst downturn in my 26 years. It's the fourth cycle, essentially. Downturn cycle. And during this cycle, we've seen a lot of people that have left the industry, and Stan, I'm sure you can relate to this. We've seen a lot of people that have left the industry, and they find it very difficult to even want to come back, because we went from everybody having, you know, permanency, as in positions. Mining companies really do look after their staff as far as, you know, share options and increases in salaries every year and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Housing, if you want to go residential, for instance, affordable housing to rent. But there are a lot of people from the mining and resources sector that won't come back because they've had to find alternative work during this 7 years, and they don't want to be bitter and twisted by the next cycle.
Yeah, there's rising gig economy in that space.
Yeah.
By that, so the FIFO guys usually, and guys, I mean in a gender neutral term, although maybe it is gendered. I mean, who knows? I mean, is it mostly guys that do it, or is it?
Well, my first mine site, there was 109 men and 11 women and 2 children. There was only 3 houses. The rest of us were all fly in, fly out, and our roster was 13 weeks on, 3 weeks home.
I'm guessing that life has got better with the internet, in the sense that, you know, there's more entertainment, let's say, or there's more connectivity with family at home, and the idea of being sort of physically distant has been ameliorated a little bit by the fact that you can do digital stuff like, you know, remote calls like this that we're doing. Is that true? Do you think is it basically it's got better as a lifestyle for people?
Social media has changed the dynamics of so many different areas within mining because, you know, when you live remotely, you have your friends as your family. It's a really different lifestyle, and it's something to get accustomed to. And, you know, I went through a stage where most of our friends would just be leaving all the time, and I thought, God, I'm not going to make any more friends because this is just crazy. The industry is so transient. It's not worth my while. Soon I got over that. But whereas now, you know, we're finding that I'm on so many different Facebook pages and groups and bits and pieces where we all support one another, because a lot of the time the emphasis has been on the employee, supporting the employee as far as, you know, when they're up on site. But what happens to the likes of the partners and the children when they're at home, and how are they being supported, not only mentally but, you know, through community support and that sort of thing? So you know, we're blessed that we've got all this technology at our fingertips, without a doubt. I mean, I used to have to line up. This is how crazy it is, and I sound so old, but I used to have to line up for sometimes up to an hour just to call my family in Perth because there was one payphone on site and there was 120 something of us living there. So, you know, gone are those sorts of days. We've got access, immediate access to our family and stuff like that, which is really good.
You know what? I mean, Facebook obviously has continued to get hammered in the press. Big tech, social media in general, has had kind of a tumultuous couple of years. There's been a big backlash against all of it. But we often don't understand or don't recognize the good that it has done. And this is almost a classic example of where it can reconnect people that were remote. And it's not a case that just because people are physically far away that you're not in touch anymore. But you know, we don't write about that. But there's question that that's been a positive thing on the planet.
Yeah. So my ex-partner was fly in, fly out, and he committed suicide almost 21 years ago. So I know all the different, you know, streams of living that remote environment, not only FIFO, but also obviously, you know, being residential in a town, it's a completely different scenario to being in Perth. You know, you come down here and it's like you're a little girl in a lolly shop. You just go crazy. There's restaurants, there's shops, there's, you know, you pack up the trailer and then you head on home and until the next time. It's a bit of a crazy lifestyle, but it's, like I said, it's one that I can't ever see my family not being involved in.
Yeah, that's amazing. And actually, sorry to hear about your sad news there, Danny, but Andrew Perrett has just mentioned something exactly on that side, where FIFO workers have higher rates of depression. And because of that kind of social dislocation, I guess, is a big part of it. And perhaps even gender imbalance has a part to play in that depression also. You know, when you've got 85-83%, I think John has just mentioned, that seems to be a big number to me. Okay, cool. Danny, what else can you tell us about recruiting for mining and resourcing? I mean, what do you know about it that you think other people outside of the industry don't?
I think, look, at the moment, well, I've recently jumped on board with a non-for-profit to essentially bring into schools the idea of mining and resources career pathways from a young age, because, like I said, unless kids grow up in the industry or they see an auntie or uncle or grandparent or father or mother or whoever, a lot of the time people just associate mining with driving a dump truck, and there is a myriad of different roles out there for everybody. From Perth, a recruitment perspective really is, you know, I set up a scarce skills report last year because I could see that there was a decline in the amount of tradespeople that we had in Perth, in the mechanical trades specifically, and some of the other engineering roles. And that has proven, you know, it's a year this week that scarce skills report was actually launched. And that's that has continued. You know, now we were paying, say, fitters 2.5 years ago, $40 to $48 an hour. We're now paying them up to $75 an hour. So, you know, when we're looking at scarce skills, when we're looking at the fact that our industry is relatively bad in not continuously training and developing our future workforce and our talent pipeline, we've got a serious issue with that. And how do we then transition candidates from a different industry who have very similar experiences? So say they might come from manufacturing and ops, for instance, so therefore they've done shift work, they have an understanding of OH&S. How can we then bring them into the mining and resources sector, hold their hand for a few months, give them the training and development that's required, and send them into a position in mining? Because so many people still want a job in our industry. It's a dynamic industry, and like I said, it's quite addictive. But you know, we as an industry really need to band together and work through that training and development model.
Yeah, Hung, Danny and I have had a few conversations about this, and that every time there's a downside to our the cycle in mining, no investment goes into all these people, the apprentices and the trainees, and then when it starts to pick up, you keep hitting this we need all these fitters. We need these. Imagine speaking to a mechanical fitter in the UK and saying, you know, in Australia, you'd be making $170,000-$180,000 a year to do the same job, because there's no skills here in Australia, because we're not investing in you know, the capability of our people for future requirements. It's crazy.
And not only that, you know, in these 7 years of this downturn, individuals have had to take it upon themselves to train and develop. Mm. Whereas before, mining companies, contract service companies, all of those, they would be throwing you through the door. My husband got a degree courtesy of Rio Tinto because he got into emergency management. So he started life as a chef. He then got on and was driving trucks. He was a contractor driving dump trucks when I met him. He then operated machinery like loaders and graders and got into fixed plant. Through that, he got into emergency response team training, which was free on site. And then he found his niche. So when we moved to Parabidou and he wanted to continue along that pathway, he went and did a degree in emergency management. Rio Tinto paid for that. You know, that's a lot of money. That's a big investment. He worked for Rio for 14 years. Now he's working for BHP. BHP do, you know, most of these larger mining companies do look after their employees and they do put them through training and development. But in the last 7 years, most people, including those candidates that want to get into the mining resources space, they need to take it upon themselves. And sometimes that could cost upwards of, like we've got some roles on at the moment that's paying $50 to $55 an hour. Those guys have to spend up to $8,000 to be trained in order to be put forward for those positions.
And do you feel that that should be the role of government, be it local or national government, to do more? Or, I mean, where would your criticism be on that? And that's a question for both you guys, actually.
Personally, me, I think it's across the board. I think the individual needs to take some kind of responsibility as far as personal training and development. But then I also think that if we continue down the path that we're currently finding ourselves in with these scarce skills, with these really scarce roles that we're just finding it far too difficult to fill, you know, we need to look at alternative avenues. And there are some lurks and perks for companies to be able to bring on apprentices and trainees and bits and pieces. But again, there's a lot of input personally from the company that has to be, you know, taken into consideration when you're bringing on a trainee and apprentice, because there is so much, you know, you have to hold their hand for a lot longer. So
you know what, you're right. Everyone needs to share the responsibility, share the burden a little bit on this. But I want to bring one of our other guests here, John Boker, because he's actually working for a business that is kind of doing something along these lines. And maybe part of the problem is, part of the reason why companies or employers don't invest in staff is because the sense that they'll lose them with no gain. Like, you invest X amount of training, this person disappears, no guarantee they're going to work for us again. Why are we doing that when my competitor is not doing the same? But of course, we know about LiveHire as a platform that's trying to disrupt that a little bit. I don't know entirely how that model works, but from what I've heard, it seems to be a little bit more about, you know, giving the candidate more opportunities to work with a kind of a cohort of employers that have agreed to, more or less, to share the visibility of their vacancies with all of the candidates that go through that. Now, I'm not sure whether these guys are big or small in the mining sector, but it seems to me it's a sort of a commercial model that might have evolved to try and solve a similar problem. So, John, I'm going to see if I can get you on here. I'm going to just invite him, see him sort of in the chat stream, so I think he's there. So let me see if I can bring him on. Danny, you stay with us on this.
Yeah.
Danny Hung, we are bringing in some laundry while it was raining today, and he got his first experience with high vis.
Oh, exciting. I can share a photo later if you like.
sounds a little bit sort of cross
all
the bone.
High-vis,
here.
We are, yes.
I mean, a high vis, for people who might be wondering what that is, it's simply high visibility uniform, right? And it's something that a lot of people who are, oh, here we go. We have John, and I believe we have Nicole there as well. Is that right? Great. So you guys, can you just introduce yourselves to the people who might not know you?
Yes, so John Bowker. I'm Commercial Manager of LiveHire here in WA.
Nicole Aguilera, I'm the Head of the People Function for Lycopodium. here in and Australia and the world.
Great to join the show, you two. John, I might have mangled what Live Hire do. Just before you came on, I kind of sort of said, yeah, you guys are kind of moving towards trying to solve this problem. Can you explain a little bit more? I mean, did I get you guys right? I mean, what is the general concept behind Live Hire?
Yeah, look, the general concept behind Live Hire is really to what we feel our vision and value is to empower the flow of the world's talent. And to do that flow of talent a lot better than what we've perhaps done it traditionally in the past using sort of the legacy traditional systems that have been out there for companies to use. So in terms of that, so you've got to kind of write candidates create a live hire profile or join the talent communities of various clients of ours. Using that profile, they can then join other similar clients that use live hire with the same profile. So not having to create multiple profiles, and then managing those profiles themselves, connecting with employers. But it's not just about a connection with an employer, it's about a system of engagement using functionality like two-way SMS and talent pool smart matching functionality to create environments for organizations and candidates to really connect in a much better way than the traditional job advert, post a job, apply, reject kind of process.
Yeah, and I think the way in which it applies to investing a little bit more, kind of not just holding on to your own candidates a little bit. It's the idea that if I'm an employer and I sign up to Live Hire, I basically agree that, you know what, I'm going to be alongside a bunch of other employers, and if candidates come through my pipeline and I reject them or whatnot, those people will get opportunities to check out other companies that have also joined the Live Hire platform.
Yeah, and they've got the ability using that profile to connect with whatever brands they want to connect with using that same instance and that same profile. Companies can't see each other's communities that are created, so they are private connections. So that's important to note, but it's not a big shared ecosystem. You do have to connect privately with those brands and those companies. And the candidates control that. And so the other benefit, I guess, to the system is that now we're starting to build out and we're seeing clients really interested in the internal mobility piece. And we're currently